Okay, folks, we are at the 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all as per usual. And as per usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or a question. And please remute yourself afterwards so that we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, contents of the deck in a PDF file, the audio track, mm-hmm. as well as contents of the chat window will go up on our website. So feel free to refer back to it. I will be pasting the URLs as they appear on the slides into the chat window for your convenience to pick them up there, but you can always pick them later on our website through the chat dialogue or on the slides themselves. We have a lot of items on the agenda tonight. I don't think we'll get through them all, but let's see how well we do. I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So we'll get started with a small share. I've been looking for a new piece of backup software, and I found this website from LifeWire.com, and it's a review of a whole bunch of backup programs, and it's really quite well done. So if you're in the market for backup software, and this is actually a pretty comprehensive list, I think there's at least a couple on there that are not on the list, which I've found. But some of the old favorites are certainly there, and a whole bunch of other things too. So, as I say, if you're interested in backup software, this is a really good resource to see what's available. Okay, moving along, Chris has a item on Windows. Except he's muted himself.
Sorry, I muted myself because my phone was ringing. So, this is a quick one. Paul Thurrott, he's a Windows guru, and he had an article the other day on ways to set up Windows for two items in particular, and that's to make sure you get a really clean installation without all the crapware that every vendor tends to throw into their machines, as well as how to bypass the requirement to use a Microsoft account to sign in during Windows setup. He does have some cautions about what will happen if you choose to go with these ways of doing it, but very clear explanations and quite good. So if you're interested in that, check out his article, and I will put that into the chat window.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Don't go away because you're up next, too, with a follow-up.
Okay, let me just paste these ones in before I lose track. Okay, so this is a follow-up to October 4th Q&A where I talked about YouTube all of a sudden blocking ad blockers or blocking your ability to see YouTube videos if you had an ad blocker in place. And so I mentioned that you could just X out of that box that came up and continue to watch the video, and I didn't know whether it was going to cause future problems, and sure enough, next. Yeah, so I had the ability to X out, next. And so a few days later, I got this pop-up coming up. Video player would be blocked after three videos, and sure enough, after three videos, I was indeed blocked from viewing any YouTube videos unless I disable my ad blockers. And I had to clear YouTube for two of my ad blockers, uBlock Origin, as well as Malwarebytes Browser Control was doing ad blocking. I had to waitlist YouTube on both of those, so I'm now happily, I guess, seeing ads on YouTube videos again. I have heard tales of some people saying that if you just log out of YouTube in your browser using your Google account and log back in, that you're able to see things again. I'm not bothering to try to bypass these things. I think it's cat and mouse game, and I will just go on seeing ads on YouTube, I guess. That's it for that one.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So uBlock Origin will actually block all the ads in YouTube, like the ones that it starts and the ones in the middle of the video?
Yeah, it was great because, it would just get rid of all ads in the middle of videos, start of videos. All of them just didn't appear. It was great.
Okay. I might try that because I only usually watch one YouTube video a week and the adverts are a nuisance.
Yeah, well, okay. You'll be able to do it for at least three videos, and then I think they'll catch on.
All right, thanks. Okay, next up we have an item from Jeff Dubois talking about the famous grandparent scam, where the scammers basically call up elderly people like us, most of us on this call tonight, and try to pretend that they're their grandson or their granddaughter or something. And you know, they say, is that grandma? And then grandma says, is that you, Jeremy? And off you go. Well, nowadays, the newest scam is to use AI to clone the voice and use that to talk to grandma. And of course, the problem is that they need a sample of a voice. And Jeff's thinking, well, an easy way to do that is to just phone somebody up and capture their voicemail message. And then you can use that as a scam voice. So grandma would be hard pressed to tell that it wasn't Jeffrey. But Jeff's solution is to use a program, or a website, Murph.ai, which is an AI text to speech engine. So he uses that to create his voicemail message, which, as he says, he's using AI to thwart AI, which is kind of a neat trick. Some of the downsides, or the issues, I guess, is that there's only a limited number of free voices you can use, if that's a concern. You can only download one, what they term, audio project, unless you buy the service, a premium plan. But you can create as many projects as you like. And he says you can still play the sound file even if you can't download it. So I guess you could still capture the audio. So this is Jeff's email message, voicemail message coming up. He says, thanks for calling my number. No one can take your call right now. Please leave your name, your 16-digit credit card number, the expiry date, and the 3-digit CVC code on the back, and we'll be sure to have someone from the bank call you back in a few days. Which I really like. If you think about that, it's actually very clever. And he doesn't think that the fraudsters are going to pick up on that, but his friends and family find it amusing, so he's happy. So there's a possibility if you're concerned about grandparents' scams. So thanks for that, Jeff. That's a really neat trick. Okay, Chris now has an item that I think came from Serge Eric originally.
Well, yeah, it was Serge Eric who turned me on to the shareware on sale. He gave a presentation at the February meeting on how you get free commercial software, and a lot of it is the stuff that comes up where they'll send you an email, and for the next 24 hours, or in this case, the next 6 days, you can get software 100% off. And sometimes there's some limitations to it. It'll be a one-year license for it, or something like that, or sometimes it's just discounts. In this case, I was kind of interested because it was 100% discount, and it's a lifetime non-commercial license. It's PhotoStamp Remover. And what it can do is remove unwanted portions of images, and it does it through what is typically called content-aware fill. And it has several modes that are built in, and so they're in-painting, hole-filling, texture generation, and quick remove. The two that I found most useful were in-painting and texture generation, and depending on the photo that I had, one would work better than the other. Generally, in-painting works the best. It's also the slowest. So what you can do also is you target a specific color in a selection area, and that can be really, really handy if you have a bunch of photos where somebody turned on in their camera the date stamp, where every photo has a date stamp in the bottom right corner typically. You can go in, you can actually target the color of that, and it does a very, very good removal of just that that stuff. You can also do a batch mode, and that is very useful where you have something that is in the same area of every photo, and you can have it go through and do them all at a time. So it's US $60 regular price, and through that link that I have pasted into the chat, you can get it for free through October 30th. Next. So how does it work? So here's an original photo I have where I want to remove the boat. And most photo editors have a clone stamp. And so why not just use clone stamp? Well, next. Cloning, typically you will end up with repeating patterns. And to get around that, you have to change the source area that you're copying from and then paste over another area and then change the source area again to something else so you don't get these repeating patterns that appear in your final image. Next. Content-aware fill, on the other hand, will take an area and it will fill that in with stuff that is similar to, but not identical to, stuff that is around the selection area. And so you typically get a very nice, natural-looking fill-in, as you see on there, with one operation. Next. So here's an example where I had some bare trees that were appearing in the top of this image, and I thought they were a little bit distracting. So next. What I did was I zoomed in on with the program, and I actually just painted over those branches. Next. And then I chose my mode, and in this case I did in painting, I think. And I click remove. Next. And every now and then you will get this with any content-aware fill program, you'll get weird artifacts sometimes appear. And this one ended up creating two weird artifacts in there, and it got rid of most of the trees that I was trying to get rid of, but it ended up with this odd stuff. So next, I just painted over those, and then I did the remove on that, and next, I ended up with a nice clean result as the final. So it was two operations for this, but did a very, very good job of removing those. Could I have done this through a clone stamp? Sure. But if with a more complex background, this would have been more difficult with a clone stamp. Next. So here's another one example where removing a boy who's jumping in the surf. Next. So I just paint over, clicked on the remove, and next. Ended up with a very natural. So you can see how it just filled it in. There's no repeating patterns. It's similar content to what's around the boy, but not identical to. So it did a really, really nice job of doing the removal on that. And so my bottom line on this is it's a very good job of content-aware fill. There are different modes that will give you different results. So you can, if one doesn't work very well, you can try another one. It might get a better result. Is it worth $60? I say here probably not. I would say definitely not. You can get a full photo editor that includes content-aware fill for not much more than $60. So for just content-aware fill, I don't think it's worth $60, but for free, definitely. So if you have a photo editor program that doesn't do content-aware fill or does it poorly, I suggest that you check this out, and until the 30th, you can get it for free.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And just a note on that, when you go to download the file, you can download it, but they send you an email. And pay attention to the email because it contains a license key, which you probably need to run the software.
Yeah, when you run the software, you have to go in and activate it. It's a trial version until such time as you paste in that license key. Just as a side note on this, I have not received a single email from the company other than that initial one with the license key. So I don't think that you have to worry about being spammed by them. But your mileage may vary, but it seemed to be pretty straightforward to me.
I think you get a ton of email from that shareware site, though.
Oh, yeah, shareware on site. You'll get at least one email a day on that offering you all kinds of things. I just very quickly look at what's 100% off and am I interested in it, and if I'm not, I hit the delete key.
And you're also allowed to unsubscribe, so it's not really a problem.
Yeah.
Okay, neat program. All right, next up is Stuart, who's going to unmute his microphone and tell us all about biometric authentication.
For Canadians.
This yes, it's a loony bit, that's right.
I was looking for a recording of a loon to start this off with, and I didn't have time to find it. But anyway, yes, ladies and gentlemen, your loony bit for the day, the week. Biometric authentication is pretty hot all around the world. Don't think Canadians have noticed that yet, but we are using it to unlock our phones, and some of us are using it to pay for things with digital wallets, your fingerprint or Face ID. And our government is doing a little head scratching and soul searching and, of course, passing the buck back to the average citizen, saying, please give us your impressions on the best way to implement digital ID for, biometric authentication for digital ID for all Canadians. Now, the link on the screen that we have in this slide is not a link to the government's page. It's a link to an article in Mobile Syrup, which discusses this in far more professional detail than I'll ever manage to do. But it has a link to the government webpage where you can identify yourself first and then get your say with what the government does about this, if you so choose. Do you have another screen, Alan? Another slide? Now, there's a company here in Canada, blueink.ca, and they've been quietly mucking about with this sort of thing for a while now. There is an app, so this now becomes not only a Looney Bit, but an Android and iOS app presentation. And this app is now supported by all Canadian provinces and maybe even the territories. And you can plug in your driver's licenses and health cards if your jurisdiction supports those things. Nexus cards, First Nations status cards, permanent resident cards, and passports are supported by this app as well. And I don't know how reliable it is. I tried sending it up on my phone and, took a sort of a blurry picture of my driver's license and I said, okay, well, close enough. It's me. But, the thing they emphasize is that it's not really official yet, this sort of thing in Canada. And they recommend that everyone keeps their physical ID with them for things like, I guess there's another slide, isn't there?
Yep.
Yes. Oh, well. Oh, yeah, no, it's up there. Yeah, not all digital versions are supported yet. So if the cops pull you over, you better have your license. Or if, you know, you're in an accident and you have to go to the hospital, you probably should have your health card because you won't have time to pull out your phone and get authenticated. But they're working on it. They're establishing a presence, and more information can probably be found on their Facebook page, but I don't have a Facebook account, so I don't really know what any more information might happen to be at the moment. I signed up for their newsletter and haven't gotten any information from them. So I don't know if Blue Ink is just sort of waiting for things to happen in the Canadian sphere or not, or what they're doing, but they exist. And you can take a look at it if you want to see what they have to offer. But if you want to see what's going on around the world, I would suggest you look at the website that is linked at the bottom of this slide, biometricupdate.com. And I'm not sure where this place is based, but there are news articles from all over the world on digital ID situations and implementations and fraud and attempts at rectifying the fraud. And it's really amazing what's going on everywhere except Canada with this sort of digital ID. So that's pretty much all I have for tonight. Keep your eyes out for it, folks.
It's coming.
You're welcome. It's coming.
Okay, next up we have an item on cable internet.
Yeah, Elizabeth is on the call tonight, and so she's added a little bit more information since then, but we'll fill that in as we go through. So her original request that she sent in to suggestion box at opcug.ca was the fact that she's using cable internet through the National Capital Freenet, so Rogers is providing the infrastructure for that. She was using the Wi-Fi connection to get to the router from her computer, and she was finding about twice a day she would have a drop on the internet connection. And she was wondering if anybody else had experienced that and if there were any ideas to troubleshoot and prevent these drops. Next. So my answer, which is covers all things technology related, that depends. There are a lot of variables that really can be coming into play in a situation like this. So my question back to Elizabeth was, does the internet connection also drop on devices if they're on a wired connection, so an Ethernet cable? And so if they do drop, then it's probably either the router itself or back on the Rogers infrastructure that is causing the problem. But if not, it's probably just a Wi-Fi propagation problem as opposed to any hardware or Rogers problem that is coming into play. Now, Elizabeth did reply to me saying that she bought the internet cable and she was going to test over a period of time. She said tonight in the chat that she hasn't had any drop since going on to a wired connection, but she really does want to go back to a Wi-Fi connection. So she was going to take this additional information back to NCF Help Desk and let them know that. Next.
Just a note, Timothy says he's had drops for about 2 months now with Rogers.
Sorry. Some days is worse than others. I may have a dropout, and then maybe 5 minutes later, another dropout.
Okay.
And the last two weeks, I also got this email from Rogers asking if I've been having problems. But I never replied back to them because I'm not too sure why all of a sudden I get this email the same time as I'm having the problems, which I never had emails from Rogers before about asking about problems.
Yeah. Okay, go to the next slide, Ellen. So I think there are some other things to try. So first off, if you're not getting drops on and when you're plugged in via Ethernet and you are having problems on the Wi-Fi, it's almost certainly going to be a Wi-Fi propagation problem. So you can do things like testing the strength of your Wi-Fi connection. There are apps that you can go to get signal strength and what channel you're on and things like that, both for a desktop as well as for a phone. And if you can check what else happens when the signal drops. If you have a large electrical motor that happens to be in between you and the router that starts up, and it can definitely cause problems like that where you get a signal drop. Can you try moving the router to get so that you're closer to your computer, or go with a Wi-Fi extender that will get you a signal strength that's stronger, closer to where you're actually using your computer. So at the September 6th Q&A, I did a bunch of slides on Wi-Fi coverage talking about these issues, placing your router at a more central location or going with a Wi-Fi extender or things like that. But almost certainly, if you are going to complain to your ISP, they are going to likely ask if you have a problem when it is plugged in on a wired connection. And if you don't have a problem there, they're probably going to wash their hands of it. And they're going to say, well, it's a propagation problem. So unless you're sitting, 3 feet away from it, then, it's almost certainly that it's going to be something in the environment that is causing this problem for you. It's going to be a hard fight to convince them that, no, it must be the Wi-Fi part of the router that is causing the problems or something like that. I think it's going to be a really hard fight for anybody to get somebody to take it seriously and do anything to fix it. Unless there are other people on the call that have, a thought as to, what can be done to actually help with this sort of stuff.
Ed is asking what time of day do the drops occur. I'm not quite sure how that flies.
Yeah, Tom suggests switching bands, and that's something that the Wi-Fi connection, the analyzers can tell you. And so if you are on the same channel or band as a lot of other people in your neighborhood, especially if you're in an environment like an apartment building or something where there's a lot of Wi-Fi connections nearby, trying to get onto a different channel or a different band, changing from 2.4 megahertz or gigahertz to 5 gigahertz or something like that might help as well. So there's a lot of things you can try to change to get your signal stronger and more consistent, but it's almost certainly going to be on you, I think.
Okay, thanks a lot. I have a Wi-Fi extender thing that's somewhere. I was just looking for it a minute ago. I can't find it.
Okay.
I'll try to see if that will help me or not. I'm not in an apartment. I'm in a house, but I'm very close to the people beside me. And when I look at the networks that are around on Wi-Fi, there's a lot of networks around me.
Yeah, so going on to a different channel, like I say, getting one of those analyzers, which will show all of the signals in your neighborhood that are showing up, it'll show what channel they're on. And if you have a bunch of you are sharing the same channel, that can definitely cause problems. So most routers nowadays, when you power them on, they will actually be on an auto setting for channel. And so they will try to find a channel that is least populated. But you may have a router that is not doing that. So, you know, it might be possible in its configuration to go in and lock it down to a channel that none of your neighbors are using. That might help. If you have the Wi-Fi extender, putting it halfway between you and the router is probably the best first place to put it.
If there is an auto configuration on your router, when you do have a blackout or it doesn't work, that's when you should unplug your router for 10, 12 seconds to let the RAM disappear, and then plug it back in again, and it'll choose the channels that are least busy at that moment, at that time, which is when you're having the problem.
Yeah.
Tristan says if you have a splitter for multiple cable outlets in a house, it can cause issues. Timothy says his dropouts have occurred at all hours. And Tom says even moving the router 90 degrees may help, which I guess is a antenna type issue.
Yeah, often the antennas on routers, you can change the orientation of them, and that can make a difference for sure. That's a good idea.
And Dale says there are companies who throttle your signal, and he quit one organization for that reason. They boosted the signal on request, but then dropped it down again a few days later.
Yeah, Wi-Fi issues can be tricky to when you have them. They can be tricky to diagnose on that. I always would prefer being on a wired connection over a wireless connection, but I realize that that's not always a practical solution.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. But don't go away because Bell has problems too, apparently.
Yeah, so this one, do not have an answer for this. So Nicholas Khoury, who is on the call tonight, he sent in an email today to suggestion box. He's using Bell.net for the email, so presumably it's a browser-based email that he's using. And last week when writing an email, he got a message on the screen saying locking. And then everything shut down. I don't know if everything means the browser or means the computer shut down. Or just what that was. And he doesn't know what happened. He called Bell, explained to them what happened. They had no reason to give him, and they couldn't help him. And so he's wondering if anybody else has experienced or potentially fixed this particular issue. So if anybody has any ideas or questions you want to pose to Nicholas, please unmute yourself and ask
or battery? Suggest.
Sorry?
Battery, or perhaps a loss of connection on the router?
Would that cause a locking message to come up? I've never seen a message come up saying locking.
Never. I haven't either. I'm just thinking that if it were a smart computer, and some of them are smart, as the battery level goes down to a critical level, it tells all the programs, hey, I'm going to shut down pretty soon. You better log out and stuff like that, and you better shut down as gracefully as you can. But that would be my guess. If your computer didn't work after that, I would suggest that's the problem. Otherwise, I don't know, some kind of maybe.
Yeah, I did some searching on it. I couldn't find anything that really pointed to that sort of thing happening. So, okay, we can cycle back to this if we have time later on tonight. So everybody put your thinking caps on. If you have any ideas, pass on. Throw them into the chat, and Nicholas can monitor that there, or we can cycle back if we have time at the end.
And Jocelyn has put an issue, an interesting post in on the Rogers issue. He says that it seems that Rogers are upgrading their network. So it's happening in different periods, and at the moment it's not. At the moment it's stable. I guess sometimes it's stable. Their customer service doesn't seem to be informed when it happens. On the side of the road there was a Rogers panel that says they're working and apologise for the inconvenience. If you see a sign like that in your neighbourhood, maybe that's why you've got a bad connection. But I doubt that's the problem. Okay, moving along, we have a question about repair shops from Andrew, and he notes the item on the CBC News that was a story about repair stores basically looking at people's data, looking at their photographs in particular. In fact, one shop had actually, one technician actually downloaded the photographs from the individual's computer. So he wants to know, how can we protect ourselves from this, and how can we hide our data without actually having to remove it before a repair? So a couple of suggestions. One is from Chris.
Yeah, so, well, I think if you're sending in your computer for repair, if it is in functioning order that you can actually do this, create a new administrator account for the repair shop to use. And so you're going to have to give them the ability to log into the computer, and most people would just give their normal user ID, which is an admin account, and that, of course, will give them access to everything in that profile. So underneath the pictures and documents and everything like that, under that profile, any files that are there, the repair person will be able to see it. But if you create a new administrator account and give them that ID, it prevents them from easily accessing other profiles. It doesn't prevent them from doing it if they're really determined, but it prevents casual snooping for sure, because they can't access any other profiles on the computer other than the one they're logged in as. Now, this is actually a good idea, regardless of anything, is to have at least one extra administrator account on your computer, because if your profile gets corrupted and you can't log in, then you may be faced with having to reinstall Windows. If you have a secondary administrator level account on the computer, you can always log in under that and hopefully troubleshoot the problem on your first profile, and try and get things corrected. You can always, there are ways of getting all the files under that, under other profiles. So it is possible to get yourself out of hot water by having a secondary administrator account. So that's my recommendation.
And I notice that Chris says that the technicians can't access the data easily.
Yeah.
And my solution would prevent it altogether, I think. And what I would do is I would suggest hiding the data by encrypting it. And I used to use a program called Xcrypt, which was really good at this. It would encrypt an individual file. Or if you encrypted a folder, it encrypted all the files inside that folder. But the problem is, The minor problem these days is that Xcrypt is no longer a free program, and now they want money for it. And it's actually surprisingly difficult, I think, to find a free program, that does encryption. Seems like an easy thing to do, but nobody seems to want to give it away. Microsoft have an encryption system, but it's no good if you're using Microsoft Home. So one possibility is to use a program like pzip, which is a zip utility program. And what you do there is you select the files and the folders that you want to hide, and then you create a zip file essentially, but at the same time you include a password. And the option, when you do that, it basically gives you, I think it's 256-bit encryption. And there's also an option, if you're really paranoid, to actually encrypt the file names so that they can't even see the file name, never mind the contents of the files. One thing to bear in mind is you want to write this password down, because if you forget it, it ain't recoverable. You're not going to be able to unencrypt your own data if you can't remember the password. The process is pretty simple. Here's File Explorer, and I've got this folder under Pictures, which is called Naughty Photographs. So I want to encrypt that using pzip. So here's pzip. I've selected Pictures, and here where I can tell it I want to archive this file to the original path, so it's going to stay in the same place. And you want to delete the files after archiving, but by default it sends them to recycle bin. Well, you don't want to do that, because then your pictures are just in the recycle bin and the technician can find it there. So choose something like secure delete, which overwrites them with nonsense so they can't actually see them. And then the other thing to do is choose this set a password. And this is the password that you want to write down, because you'll need it when you want to recover the files. So then when you do that, notice that we're creating a zip file and we're using 256-bit AES encryption technology, which is, I would suggest, is pretty secure. So here's what you end up with. You end up with my folder is now called pictures.enc for encryption.zip. And if I try to open this in File Explorer, it tells I can go down to, see, I didn't encrypt the file names, and I can get down to the picture, but it can't extract it because it's actually an encrypted file. And even if you have pzip available, when you try and extract the file with pzip, you need to enter the password. So if the technician doesn't know the password, he ain't going to be able to get to the photographs. So now the question is, what was that photograph of the naughty boy that the technician was unable to see? Well, all the gentlemen on the call tonight now have to close your eyes, because this is only a picture that's available to the ladies on the call. So you've got your eyes closed? Okay, so there it is. There's the naughty boy, ladies. And now we'll move on to another item. Okay, so now we're going to hear the good things about servicing. And Bob Harris is going to take over and tell you his experience with a door-to-door repair service.
Okay, thank you, Alan. Okay, and we're going to go to here and share screen. You should see my screen here now, if that goes well.
Yes.
Okay, great. So I'd like to show you a new repair service, as Alan said, but new to me anyway. So I bought my drone about 2 years ago. Is that a full screen for you guys?
Yes.
Good. About 2 years ago. And I bought the whole kit with extra batteries, and this is actually the same one that Bob Gowan has and Bob Walker has. I don't know who else has this too. Anyway, this has been a great thing. And over the past 2 years, this drone has had over 200 very successful flights. Been lots of fun for me. I've learned a whole lot of things. I've logged over 16 hours of flight time with this drone, doing all kinds of things. And have it in my videos and other items. This drone has traveled over 87 kilometers in total. And things were going really well until a couple of Thursdays ago. I tend to do a hand catch and a hand launch. And I did a hand launch, and it didn't really launch. It just fell 6 feet to the ground. That wasn't, something was wrong, probably me anyway. And I lost a leg, broke out some components, and the screws ripped out, and the damage was quite severe. From watching some of the Facebook groups, this can be a very expensive repair on the drone guys and stuff. And anyway, this is where we are right now. And this is when I discovered Fix Revolution. I looked at this website, and Debbie saw it too. Debbie saw it first, actually. And they had a quick thing, and they fix cell phones, game consoles, and they do micro soldering, and they pick up and deliver. I looked more in depth, and sure enough, they have quite a little shop. They have a map for a service area that they covered in the website. They got more involved in this, and this is starting to look pretty good. So welcome to Fixed Revolution. We come to you, mobile repair shop. We specialize in a wide range of devices, including cell phones, laptops, and in my case, drones. Well, I'm looking pretty good. This is looking pretty friendly to me, and I could be flying again maybe. So anyway, I looked at this a little further, and now I'm not sure how many people have drones here, but they fix more than drones. Why, you folks may be interested. So, and going on further, here's what they offer. So they say, is your device having problems? We've got you covered. Cracked screens, batteries, charging ports, a backlight issue. They troubleshoot it and repair. They don't just replace things. They repair the problems. I love that kind of mentality. Anyway, and micro soldering board level repairs is not an incorrect grammar term. That means they're actually replacing the tiny components on the circuit boards. And once again, this is not done in some faraway land. This is done right here in Ottawa. Well, as they say, what do you want to fix today? Well, they do pretty much everything that you people have in your pockets. They do Samsung, Google phones, LG, iPhones, and the list just keeps on going. They have going on here iPads, iPad minis, Samsung tablets, Android tablets. And we're not finished yet because there's lots more, too much to go through here tonight. But they do laptops, game consoles, Chromebooks, and on and on. Very impressive. And, of course, the areas they cover, we're very fortunate. They cover near every corner of the Ottawa-Gatineau area. They come to your door. Well, he couldn't get better than that. Now, I hear somebody complaining here. But very impressive service here. But what if you reside outside of Ottawa in Saskatoon or Shawinigan? Well, don't worry, Stuart. They have you covered, too. They have a convenient mail-in repair service. Here's how it works. You fill in the form, pop it in a box, and away you go. This is done especially for Stuart. Anyway, why choose Fixed Revolution? They go in about their pricing, their experience, 90-day warranty. The actual repair is warranted for 90 days. You can't beat that. Their experience, their reviews are wonderful. After reading all this, it didn't take long for me to say, I'm all in, so let's get started. Well, I go online, get myself a free quote to schedule my pickup or my repair. It's quite easy to do. Everything's very professional. I might add that I gave them 5 or 6 photographs of the drone, the model, serial, as much content as I could get together for the drone, the purchase date, everything for them. So whatever you repair, give them lots of data. Anyway, so I started the process on a Friday afternoon. I was busy on the Tuesday, so I picked Wednesday as my pickup date. And lo and behold, my perfectly repaired drone was delivered right back to my home on Friday, October 13th, 2 days after they had picked it up. And it's beautiful. Revolution. If you folks have a device that might need repair, I would say this is a worthwhile company to contact. Laptops, cell phones, tablets, Chromebooks. I hope the other Bobs on the call, Bob Walker and Bob Gowan, do not need this service for their drones, but they do much more than drones. This is a new service to me, and I found it interesting, and hope you folks do too. That's all.
A couple of people are asking about how much was the repair, Bob?
$150 as quoted, $150. And for the damage I had, I knew it was comparable to Facebook groups, and the factory ones were much more than that. So I had $150. I was thrilled with that, for sure.
Elizabeth's wondering if they can fix 3 CD changers, and she's going to ask them.
Yeah.
But she wants to know whose house it was.
That's a timber cross home. I'm photographing a video of a construction site as it progresses from start to finish.
And that video is on the web somewhere. So if you're interested, contact Bob and he'll give you the URL, I'm sure.
It's on my YouTube channel. Search Bob Harris.
Okay. Thanks very much. Bob,
thank you.
So I think we have time for this next item, which is from Chris, actually from Richard, but via Chris again.
Yeah, Richard sent in an email to me about private browsing and DNS cache, and this I think stemmed from my most recent article in the newsletter talking about private browsing. And he mentioned that a previous OPC UG discussion somewhere claimed that private browsing didn't empty the DNS cache. And he thought, if true, that was a grievous oversight, and the cache would actually show all of the sites you visited, even if you use private browsing. And so the way the DNS cache works, just as a very brief aside, when you do a DNS lookup to a site, so say you want to go to opcug.ca, the operating system will go and ask the DNS server, what's the IP address for this, and put it in a cache so that if you go again 5 minutes later or something, you don't have to do that DNS lookup again. It'll have it in the cache. So the cache, yes, is a file on disk, and it will show you all the sites that you visited. And so Richard says that after closing a private browsing, he will always run from the command line, elevated as an administrator, ipconfig space, there should be a space there, and then /flush DNS. And that will actually delete everything out of the DNS cache. Next. So ChatGPT actually agrees on this. So I queried ChatGPT, and they came back, and they said, yeah, DNS cache is a system-level cache. So it's maintained by the operating system. And in private or incognito browsing modes, don't typically flush the DNS cache. And I'll go so far as to say they can't flush the DNS cache. They do not have the ability to do so. It's a system-level service that is being provided. So they say that the private browsing mode is designed to provide privacy by not storing browsing history, cookies, and other data on your computer, but it doesn't affect the DNS cache. So to clear it, you have to do that. Open the command prompt as the administrator and type in ipconfig space flush DNS and press enter to get rid of the DNS cache. Next. So yes, but I don't think it's a grievous oversight on the part of the private browsing mode on any of the browsers because of the fact that the DNS cache is not under control of the browser. It's under control of the operating system and it is operating as designed. So there's nothing in the DNS cache system that is designed to say, oh, but don't cache, you know, the following entry or don't cache it for the next 5 minutes. You can turn off DNS caching totally if you really want to, but I wouldn't suggest that from a performance point of view, it's probably better to leave it on. As I pointed out in my article, you know, private browsing is all cracked up to be. Private browsing is not a panacea. It is not meant to be a cure-all for everything. Next. One of the things that I think is even more so who cares in this sort of situation is there's a time to live on all DNS lookup records. And typically they're quite short. I looked in my DNS cache the other day when I was putting together these slides, and most of them had a time to live of under 5 minutes. And so these are going to expire out of the cache anyways in very short order. The longest that people typically set up DNS records for would be an hour or maybe in some cases a 24-hour, you know, for stuff that you know is going to be static over long periods of time. You don't want people wasting their time doing DNS lookups. So it's probably far easier that you're going to get tracked through some other means than somebody who has physical access to your computer to be able to look at your DNS cache file. But I guess, as they say, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. So, yeah, flushing the DNS cache will remove this way that local users on your computer could track places that you visited if you really want to get down to that level.
So Tom notes that DNS holds IP addresses, not websites.
It actually it includes the domain names because it is the cache to say, you know, of the following DNS name translates to the following IP address. Okay. If you do a ipconfig space slash, I think it's display DNS, it'll actually display all your DNS records.
That's right, and I just did that, and it goes on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And you can see all the things that got displayed or got looked at for, it looks like, since you logged on, and there's all kinds of strange things, like www.pageinebeyondcge.it, which, and I haven't been visiting any Italian websites.
Yeah. Anyhow, I think it's one of the things that I worry least about from a security point of view on my computer. But if you are worried about it, the instructions are there how you can clear the cache.
So Tim notes of that marketplace story about technicians accessing people's computers. Some of them had looked up the website browsing history. Tom also notes here, DNS is also flushed when restarting. So does that mean when rebooting?
I don't know. Tom, do you know?
That's what I meant. When you restart your computer or reboot your computer or when you turn it off, it's all kept in RAM because you want fast access to it. So it disappears. Okay. Now, I suppose it might be, I suppose it's possible that it's captured in virtual memory and stored in your cache thing. I don't know, but ordinarily, unless it's there, it would be totally gone.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're in the last 10 minutes. I asked earlier in the chat window if anybody had any other questions or things to share. If you do, now's the time. Otherwise, we have an extra item, which is pretty short, we could probably get to. Okay, so let's do that, Chris. So you've got another item here from Nicholas.
Yeah. So this came in again to the suggestion box at opcug.ca. So folks, it really does work. If you want to have something addressed or you want to share something with the group, that's the address to do it to. So this came from Nicholas as well. And he is asking, why is print dialog box changes? So he has a Canon Image Class MF4770 printer. And previously, he would highlight something that he wanted to print, press Control-P, and he would get a two-part screen. So on the left side, it would show what it was going to print. And on the right side, it would give him the ability to change features like number of copies, double-sided, whatever. And then at the bottom, there'd be two buttons, print and cancel. And now he goes to it, and what he gets is the same screen, but instead of print and cancel, he gets save and cancel. He says he did not make these changes, and it changed by itself. Well, actually, I would go so far as to say probably you did, but you didn't realize it. And I'll tell you what I think is probably the most likely thing. Next. So I think that the print destination got changed. So here we look at two dialog boxes. Now, Nicholas didn't tell me what he was trying to print from. Print dialog boxes can vary from one program to another and so forth. But here's one where it gives those same buttons. So in one case, I'm printing an email, and I can see that I have print and cancel. And in the other dialog box, I have a different one. I have save and cancel. So this sounds like identical to what Nicholas has run into. Next. The difference here is that the destination has changed. So in the destination, the first one is actually a printer. It's my laser printer. And in the second one, it's set to save to PDF, which is one of the options when you go to print. You can actually save to PDF, and it's a system-level Windows driver that provides this. And rather than sending it to a printer, it's going to save it to a file. And that's why the dialog box changes to say save and cancel rather than print and cancel. Next. So rather than printing, you're actually saving to a file. So what you have to do is just change your print destination to be your printer as opposed to save to PDF. I'm pretty sure that's what the problem is. If it's not the problem, let us know. Screenshots of what you're actually getting would be helpful in trying to diagnose it. I just noticed Tom asked, how do you get the wavy bottom border? That is part of my screen capture program, Snagit. Okay, next.
Wavy bottom, oh, there, yes.
Okay. Yeah, so I just chop out the middle of large dialog boxes to make them smaller. So this actually goes beyond what Nicholas was having a problem with, though, and this is why I thought this was in particular a good one for the entire group. How Windows manages default printer. Now, sometime, I think a couple of years ago, Microsoft changed the default as to how printers are managed. Okay, they added an option in settings, says allow Windows to manage my default printer. And when they made this change, they helpfully checked this box for everybody. And so they are now having it that this is enabled by default. So what does this actually mean? Next. It's a change in behavior, and what it is you get automatic default printer switching. So whenever you choose a new printer, it becomes the default printer. So when you go to print something else, it will now try to use that other device as your default printer. In this case, I suspect at some point that Nicholas did a print to PDF, and then it changed the default printer to be print to PDF file. Personally, I really hate that default printer switching. I know what my printer is. I want it to be the default printer. Anytime I want to do something different than that, I will go and make that change at that point in time. Next.
You're radical, Chris.
What's that?
You're a radical.
Yeah. I don't like Microsoft changing behaviors and then making it a new default on me. If you're like me, I should put Chris's rant at the top of this. I haven't had a rant in a little while here. So if you like me, don't like this behavior, go to Settings, Bluetooth and Devices, Printers and Scanners, and there will be a checkbox there for allow Windows to manage my default printer, and I suggest clearing that box so that Windows doesn't change your default printer every time you choose a new device. But if you toggle that to off, okay, you can then set what your default printer is, okay, rather than leaving it whatever it happens to be at that point in time. You can go to settings, Bluetooth and devices, printers and scanners, click on your preferred printer, and then you will have an option to set as default. With that toggled off of allow Windows to manage my default printer, that will always be your default printer. Every time you go to print, it should always be trying to do it to that. If you need to print to some other device or print to a PDF, then you would have to choose it at that point in time.
But you choose it temporarily then?
Yeah, that's the way I do it. And the next time it'll be back to my printer, which is what I want as a default. Or, you know, it's whatever device you want as your default, it will stay as the default.
Yeah, you see, that's your problem. Microsoft doesn't believe that what you want is what you want.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. That's the end of the last 10 minutes. Micheline had a question. How do the police check your computer history? Now, other than checking your browser history in your browser, I actually don't know. If anybody knows the answer to that question, let us know. I'm sure there's some deep forensic analysis that you can do, but I don't know what it is. Okay, so we've had our hour's worth. I think we've answered most everybody's questions. If we haven't, you have another chance next week. But in the meantime, let me just note that in 2 weeks, on November the 8th, we have our next regular club meeting, and it's the astronomy session with Howard Simcova, who previously was with the Montreal Planetarium, and he's an avid astronomer, and he's going to be talking about eclipses of the sun and the moon. So if it has any interest to you, join us in 2 weeks on November the 8th for that presentation. But before that, next week, we have our next Q&A session. We already have some stuff in the pipe that we didn't get around to tonight, but we're always looking for more new and interesting things. So if you have any questions or if you have any follow-up answers to what we've talked about previously, topics that you'd like to share, such as your drone failure experience, whatever, then send us a note and we'll add it to the agenda. So that's it for me for tonight. Hope everybody enjoyed it, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for showing up, folks. We'll see you next week.